This episode of the Good Health Podcast is brought to you by W Wellness, my go-to online store for practitioner-quality supplements. W Wellness is all about quality you can trust. Every product is carefully curated, third-party tested, and made in therapeutic doses. So you know you're getting exactly what your body needs without the fillers or the fluff. To help you get started, I've put together a free nutritionist-recommended supplements guide with my top picks for different health goals, all available from W Wellness. And of course, you can use my code Nicole20. You can download the guide right now for free via the link in the show notes and start building your supplement toolkit with confidence. Now let's jump straight into this week's episode.
Welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Good, a certified functional medicine practitioner, registered nutritionist, and author. In this podcast, we delve into the world of energy and immune health and wellness with positivity, from optimal health and energy to stress and burnout, right through to immune conditions such as thyroid and autoimmune disease. We deep dive into functional medicine, nutritional medicine, and lifestyle medicine, as well as the personal stories of our amazing guests, from Olympians to famous faces and guest experts from all different parts of the health and wellness world. It's time to stop letting your health hold you back and become the optimal version of you. Don't forget to come and join the conversation on Instagram at good_health, that's G-O-O-D-E, or visit the website nicolegoodhealth.com to find out more.
Before we dive deeper into causes and treatments, I think it's really helpful to start with a little bit of clarity, because while eczema, psoriasis and rosacea, they're all sort of skin conditions, they are quite different, you know, in how they show up and also what's sort of happening beneath the surface. So Angela, welcome to the Good Health Podcast. It's really great to have you here to begin with. Could you kind of just start by sort of briefly defining each of these conditions? So the eczema, the psoriasis and the rosacea that we're talking about today, what are they and what differentiates them?
First of all, if we talk about eczema, eczema is an umbrella term for inflammation affecting the skin, otherwise known as dermatitis. And what you'll classically see is redness and scale. And there are numerous types of causes. And probably one of the first things that we really think about when we talk about eczema is atopic dermatitis. And this is this genetic propensity to developing the skin inflammation, the scale, redness. And there's a massive genetic component. So you are just predisposed to developing this. And really what happens is the cells, rather than sitting flush together, sit a little bit less obviously together, which means changes in the microbiome or bugs can get in, and inflammation also secondarily sets in. So it's not something that patients have caused, it's something that they're just predisposed to, and there is a massive environmental component to that as well, which we'll obviously come into. And there's ways of treating it as well. And within that, with the atopic dermatitis and that genetic predisposition, you also have other things like, on a sort of same umbrella term of eczema, but as a separate entity, contact dermatitis, irritation on the skin. And that within contact dermatitis can be an irritant contact dermatitis or allergic contact dermatitis. And then you have things like adult onset eczema or other more widespread causes, drug-induced eczema, etc. That's eczema. And I think the next question you asked me is, what's psoriasis? Is that right?
Yeah, psoriasis and rosacea.
Okay. So they are all three of these, eczema, psoriasis, and rosacea, are what we term as chronic inflammatory skin conditions, but they all have slightly different pathophysiology. So with psoriasis, again, there is a genetic component to this. So if you have psoriasis, generally, there's a sort of 5% predisposition that another relative will have it. And there is an increased turnover of your skin cells. So, for example, someone that doesn't have psoriasis, from the cells growing and sort of migrating and then being shed, and this is all part of this process called epidermal turnover, it should take about 30 days. But in psoriasis, it takes 3 days and these cells aren't naturally shed. So you almost get like a thickening in certain areas of your skin, which is known as psoriasis plaques. And again, this plaque, there's increased blood supply. So if you try and pick it, there's a certain sign that we see when we get increased blood, basically, as you pick this area. Not typically itchy, but you can sometimes get predisposition to arthritis or nail changes as well. And there's a certain immune profile that we see with that. There's a certain immune profile that we see with psoriasis. It's what we call sort of Th17 to IL-23. This sort of increase of something called TNF-alpha. And with eczema, there's a slightly different profile if it's atopic dermatitis, Th2 profile. With rosacea, it is chronic, so it does wax and wane. And again, this is to do with how probably you react to things on the skin. Sometimes it's a sort of extension of skin sensitivity, but I'm quite clear to say skin sensitivity as a whole is a different entity to rosacea. But with rosacea, we think it's probably multifactorial. There seems to be be this Demodex mite that's in you and I, but those people or those patients with more severe rosacea, the studies show that they do have more of this Demodex mite and an increased inflammatory response to that via various receptors. Patients with rosacea can often have eye signs, and those patients with bowel concerns and certain things known as inflammatory bowel disease do seem to be more predisposed to rosacea. So there is this crosstalk between the skin microbiome and the gut microbiome. Not saying that if you need to treat rosacea only by treating your microbiome, but it's probably contributing to how it presents on the skin.
Brilliant. That was a really good rundown of the three. It really helped people. I think so. You know, we've sort of touched on, we're going to dig in more into each of these, but I think we sort of looked at some of the health conditions, I guess, that you can get with the skin. From a dermatology perspective, what defines healthy skin? Because that's what we're looking at. So what defines a healthy skin, or what are early signs that somebody has experienced inflammation or imbalance before they get to the point of being diagnosed with something like eczema rosacea?
So I Googled this. I wanted to know what AI thought. And then I looked at some studies. And then actually I asked a few friends of mine this question. And it really depends on your outlook in life. So AI tells me it's hydrated, shiny, baby soft skin, even toned, no pores, no dyspigmentation. But really, depending on the age bracket of the person you ask, it's to do with happiness, a glow, which is probably more coming from within. I'll see a spectrum of patients in my clinic, some wanting different types of treatments. But generally, I think probably healthy skin, I'm going to say, is happy skin. And that happiness probably radiates from within. And I think that's really important. You know, the sun shines out of your eyes. When you crinkle, when you smile, and the sun shines from your eyes. I think those are important points to bear in mind, first of all. And something that I really do want to push from a dermatology perspective. Yes, to stay hydrated, we need to think about skincare, we need to think about gut skin health, thinking about healthy diet, even tone, reduce your pores. You know, do we think about various procedural aspects of dermatology? That is another layer. But really, it all starts from within, from happiness within your network of friends and family, your diet, your health regime.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, how AI, you know, I mean, AI is a whole other topic of conversation, but it is interesting how AI sees something differently to how we might look at something. You know, it has a very sort of, the definition you gave there for the AI is, it's quite prescriptive. And actually, I think you're right. I think healthy skin, a lot comes down to a feeling. You know, we say it, don't we? If you feel good in your skin. What's really interesting as well is that we're seeing more and more adults, I think, than ever kind of struggling with chronic skin issues, you know, conditions, things like the eczema, the rosacea, things we talked about. Quite often, they were sort of conditions that maybe people said you would grow out of them. But a lot of people now, 30s, 40s, 50s, are sort of starting with some of these conditions. They're experiencing flare-ups maybe for the first time. Things like stress maybe have an impact on that. You know, from a functional kind of medicine perspective, I often see a lot of these things in combination with the factors that I'm working with. So chronic stress, gut health imbalances, nutrient deficiencies, environmental toxins, and all these other issues. It's rarely just one trigger as well, is what I would say. There's usually quite a lot that I see in clinic, and there's a lot going on. From a sort of dermatology standpoint, are you noticing this rise too, sort of in people really kind of getting new flare-ups of this sort of later on? And what do you think kind of is driving that?
So chronic, we are living longer, which is a good thing. So chronic diseases will be presenting themselves potentially more as we get older. But also there's this concept of epigenetics, how our environment, the oxidative stress in our environment through pollution, through ultraviolet radiation, through toxins in the environment, and also stress, diet, and having a diet with additives and certain sort of processed foods will also be presenting on our skin through a process of what we know as DNA methylation. So we are actually changing the way our skin presents itself, which we tiredness, increased pores, dyspigmentation. There is an element of that. But probably also we are understanding how the disease process works from within our body and also presenting on the skin. So the microbiome, so this is at least 2 billion organisms, or I've just read an article that said 2 trillion organisms that are on the skin. So your fungi, your bacteria, your viruses, and there is crosstalk between your gut and your skin health. And we definitely know with something like rosacea that if you have bacterial overgrowth, small bowel bacterial overgrowth, those patients, and that's a certain sort of entity in itself, those patients are more likely to get flares of rosacea. So there is this crosstalk. And actually, if you treat, and there's some newer studies that come out, that are coming out with probiotics, they can potentially help inflammatory skin diseases, but in a conjunction with other therapies. And I guess probably, are we living in a more stressful environment? Are we hearing about more stresses now just with the element of social media? Are we reading more? Are we being our own doctors? So increasingly, patients are self-treating and needing to self-treat because of a lack of availability to get to the right health professional. So is that also developing in chronic stress and chronic disease as well?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of factors there, isn't there? Let's look at eczema a little bit more now. We said we'll dive into sort of each of these. Eczema is often one of those sort of first signs that there is a sort of, you know, skin barrier immune system kind of under strain. I think a lot of people kind of see it as it's dry, itchy skin, but it's more than that. It's a signal that there's something else going on beneath the surface. So what's actually happening at that sort of skin level or deeper when someone has eczema? What's really kind of going on?
Yeah, so you've got your skin barrier. So you've got your stratum corneum, which is like the bricks and mortar. In dermatology, we sort of say this dead cell layer, this corneocyte, horny cell layer you'll hear us talking about. But actually, you know, it's very much the bricks and mortar and that sort of setup before keeping bugs away, keeping moisture in, thermoregulating ourselves. And actually, when you look at it in more detail, it's got things, got lots of fatty acids, cholesterol, these things called lamellar bodies that are all basically the mortar within these sets of bricks. In eczema, because of, and that's your stratum corneum, but lower down, you have typically in the sort of more genetic type, you have a loss of a certain protein that sits, allows those cells to sit together. So the cells are not sitting very flush. Lots of water can get out. So the skin looks, feels dry. You get overgrowth, often in eczema, of something called Staphylococcus aureus. So it's a type of bacteria, which can then cause this process of itch through release of certain itch mediators. The skin gets inflamed in eczema, and that's just this predisposition to inflammation because your immune system slightly switched. And it typically happens in sort of very quite specific areas. So the inner aspects of your arms, behind your legs, often you can get it here as well in the neck. And you can, and that's the sort of the one way you can get it associated with asthma and hay fever, potentially what we call the atopic march. But otherwise, you can get other types of eczema. So sometimes if you get a little bit itchy or a little bit irritated, it could be an overuse of certain active products. Don't get me wrong, I love my skincare. I love a retinoid, it's retinoic acid. But overuse can definitely stimulate, as well as all the goodness, it can also disrupt that skin barrier. So that gets cracked and you get all that. It's sort of almost replicating the atopic dermatitis process.
And for many people, eczema is kind of unpredictable as well, right? So their skin can kind of seem quite calm one week, the next it might be kind of itchy, inflamed again. And that's quite frustrating, I think, for people. Whenever I see people with eczema, they are quite frustrated with it. I think they can't quite maybe pinpoint what's causing that. So what are the most common triggers or aggravators you see that really do cause those kind of fluctuations for people?
Really, stress is such a massive factor. You know, really this cortisol axis, so you get stress, increased adrenaline. The downstream effect is this increase in cortisol levels. Sometimes you get an increase in acne, but really it causes this itchy flare on the skin. And don't get me wrong, you can treat the skin with topical steroids. It has this amazing effect of reducing inflammation. But when you have the sort of endogenous, your body's cortisol levels increase in secondary to stress, it does have this downstream effect of making you feel itchy. And that itch process with the stress setting off eczema. We've definitely talked about skincare and irritants, sometimes contact allergies as well. So perfumes, certain metals, so perfumes and perfume products or fragrance cleaners or household equipment, certain surfactants. So these are products within cleaning that just basically allow us to take away grease that can be irritating on certain skin types. There's preservatives in topical skincare and also leave-on products and cleaning equipment. These are all prime examples of irritations on the skin.
Yeah, I have to be really careful with laundry liquids.
Oh, bless you. Really, what happens?
Yeah, so I will get like sort of itchy, sore. And I don't have eczema, it's not something I would say I like really suffer with.
Yeah.
If I don't use the laundry liquids, I'm fine. But I have to use a more natural product. I mean, which I obviously doing what I do, I try and do anyway. But I just noticed it just felt like a little bit itchy and just not, you know, sort of not Yeah, not quite right. And that was quite often with laundry liquids.
But also some of the biologics, right? The sort of biological detergents that have these enzymes can be more irritating on the skin as well. I find nail acrylates, I love getting my nails done. You know, shellac nails, those acrylates. But, you know, those methacrylate monomers are hardened on the skin. They are so allergenic. At the moment, I'm okay, but I'm just, at some point, I'm going to be sensitized to when it's gooey on the skin. That's what you want to avoid. Don't let it touch the skin, because that's when you can get really severe changes. And we sometimes get patients with splitting of the nails, what we call onycholysis. The nail comes off the nail bed. Around the nail, you get loads of redness, swelling, nail infection. And so, and once you've got that, you can't use shellac nails. But at the moment, I can.
I used gel nails for years, like years ago now. And I did use gel nails a lot. And in the end, I got the lifting of the nail.
Oh, no.
And I can't use it now. I mean, I'm okay if I have it like once to go on holiday. It's like, that's fine. But it's not something that I can use. I can use regular, fine with nail varnish, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd say use a topical steroid, which I'm very happy to prescribe for you, and then get your nails done. Because sometimes you just want nice nails. I mean, yeah. I would be biting my nails otherwise. And I do. If I leave it too long, my nails are literally flea bitten. So it's like this psychological thing, having gel nails. But there we are.
So for those who have relied on things like sort of topical steroids and things that you mentioned there, and they have maybe found that the skin's become more reactive, or maybe, you know, like you said, they work very well, but is there ever a time, I guess, where those sort of topical steroids stop working quite so well? Or, you know, is there anything else they can do alongside the steroids to kind of help restore that balance and calm that inflammation in eczema specifically?
I mean, there is a number of Cochrane reviews or meta-analyses, so really top-level evidence that shows if you've got eczema and atopic dermatitis, we really know that topical steroids are the best evidence to effectively reduce that inflammation, restore the skin barrier, and reduce your risks of infections. And infections, you know, if you get an infection that goes into your blood, known as bacteremia, you can really result in very severe presentations in hospital. So we want to avoid that. The risk of skin thinning and increased blood supply, increased sort of presentation of these blood vessels on the skin, if you're with chronic steroid use, really, if it's used under a dermatologist and on a skin that needs it, it will not happen. But increasingly, we are seeing these issues with topical steroids or long-term topical steroid use. And for sure, I would say when you're using a topical steroid, when you want to stop, definitely tailor it down. So reduce it slowly. So if you're using it once a day for 2 weeks, you use it once every other day for 2 weeks, and then once a week for 2 weeks. So because you do get this rebound redness, rebound erythema, this slight worsening of the skin. And when you stop suddenly. And often that's to do with skin that's being treated very adequately and then suddenly loses the stimulus of treatment. And so your body is almost in this feedback loop. We definitely do see contact allergies to steroids. They are rare, and that would present with a sudden worsening when you're using the steroid as opposed to stopping the steroid. But yes, we have seen a morphology that looks very different to a morphology of eczema when patients are coming off steroids. But really, I would say that if you have a condition that's been diagnosed by a dermatologist as an eczema needing steroids, for sure, the downstream effects or the consequences of untreated eczema for us can affect your quality of life much more than using steroids under appropriate guidance.
And again, it's that feeling we talked about at the beginning, that feeling good about yourself, feeling like you've got healthy skin. You know, something like eczema can be frustrating and difficult for people to live with as well. It's, you know, it's not vanity.
For sure. But ceramide, so there's more products now that are on the market that contain ceramides or moisturizers. And we know that if that really helps, when it sets into the skin barrier in moderate eczema, can really help to make a difference. So really using the right moisturizer and more ointment-based moisturizers rather than cream-based, because there are often a certain number of additives in creams that can be more irritating. So ointment-based products with ceramides are brilliant for patients with eczema.
When it comes to looking after our skin, I think it's important to remember that modern life places a lot of stress on it, from pollution and UV exposure to lack of sleep and constant low-grade inflammation. Even with the best nutrition and lifestyle habits, our skin sometimes needs a little bit of extra support, both topically and from within. I always say it's about balance, using skincare that protects and repairs the barrier while nourishing the body internally with the nutrients that build healthy skin cells. And when we look at internal support, things like omega-3 fatty acids, antioxidants, and vitamin C are some of the most science-backed nutrients for reducing inflammation and promoting repair. I also love targeted formulations that combine these, for example, Bare Biology's omega-3, Wild Nutrition's Skin, Hair, and Nails, Artis Cellular Defense, or Altrient Liposomal Vitamin C. All of these, plus lots of really great skincare brands, are available through w-wellness.co.uk, where you can use the code Nicole20 for 20% off. All the links are in the show notes below. Now let's get back to the episode. So moving on to psoriasis, let's take a look at that.
Yeah.
It's quite different to eczema. Again, it's this kind of systemic inflammatory condition, immune overactivation. And with this one, like you said, you know, skin cells are multiplying a lot faster than normal. Again, one of these conditions that can be triggered by sort of so many different things. Let's start with, can you explain with sort of what's happening beneath the surface with psoriasis? How's the immune system kind of involved in this one, and how are those skin cells sort of interacting?
There is an inflammatory loop, so the immune cells are activated. I think probably, first of all, there's this increased cell turnover. So the skin that should be shed within 30 days is shed in 3 days. And rather than being shed, it often just stays on the skin. And if untreated, you get these very thick, scaly plaques that are quite striking in psoriasis, often elbows, like we talked about earlier, the sacrum, so base of the back, knees, for like chronic plaque psoriasis. And there's other types of psoriasis. There's guttate psoriasis, there's inverse psoriasis, you can get sort of scalp and genital psoriasis as well. There's nail involvement. So it can be very extensive. And in some situations, you know, you can get something called psoriatic arthropathy, so where the joints are also involved. So there is this immune change is probably what I'd say. But really with psoriasis, we are heading towards we have such phenomenal treatments available that really target the immune system. And something, there's this bad beer and this and a number of colleagues in dermatology have really changed the profile of psoriasis. So it's so treatable. So even though it's a chronic skin condition and there was this feeling of contagiousness or this adverse feeling about psoriasis, those severe presentations it's really changed our landscape. And I'm so proud to be a dermatologist at the moment to be able to see how it's changed. So yes, you get immune increased thickening of the cells. You get this immune profiling with like inflammation of various types of cells and a certain sort of, it's what we call this. So you have an immune, you have Th1, Th2, Th17. These are the different types of arms of how your immune system works. And this is your sort of second type of immune system, should we say, your adaptive immune system. And yeah, so it's an overpresentation of one type, so the Th17 one. So there is an increase of immune cells, increased blood supply, and lots of other things going around, yeah.
It's great that there's so much out there now that can deal with it, and that there's new things, and that it's more understood in terms of it, a whole body approach to it being understood. You know, on that, I think lifestyle as well. I think, again, here we've talked about stress already with the eczema, but I think, again, stress with psoriasis is... It's sort of a big factor, isn't it? You know, supporting the body with sort of anti-inflammatory nutrition as well, things like that. You know, your omega-3s and antioxidants, colourful plant foods, all of those things. But beyond those kind of prescription treatments, what role do kind of lifestyle factors play?
Vitamin D supplementation, omega-3, anti-inflammatory, high-dose omega-3. There is evidence to show that anti-inflammatory profile will help with patients with eczema, with psoriasis. So I absolutely am a real fan of that. And also stress, smoking will make psoriasis worse. Taking certain types of tablets as well, certain blood pressure and tablets can make psoriasis worse. And then diet. So yes, if we have an anti-inflammatory diet, so no sugar, no gluten, it will reduce a lot of inflammation. And we know that if you have a very calorie-restricted diet as well with more complex foods as opposed to those high sugar foods, will make a difference. I'm all about more of a holistic approach. But for sure, if you have psoriasis, there is great evidence for medical treatments for, and that's really important to get across as well as, so doing it as a whole. So yeah. For sure, I will talk about supplements and I'll talk about positive mental well-being. And stress, again, is really important to be mindful. We live in a society where, you know, we're going at 110 miles an hour, 5-10 minutes of well-being a day. I mean, I'm not saying I don't practice as I preach, but, you know, 5-10 minutes of well-being a day, trying to sleep well will make a difference for all these inflammatory skin presentations.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. It's not about either or. It's a case of
putting it together,
putting everything together, and everybody looking. But I think I do think as well, it's quite empowering when we're taking medication for something as well. It is quite empowering to also do something yourself to help yourself. So I think if people feel like, well, I am working on my sleep or I'm doing, you know, stress management and things like that, and they have a little bit of control over a condition, Because sometimes with these things, we can feel quite out of control. Take your medications, then if you can do some of those things around it as well to sort of help you pull back on that and then feel like you've got a bit of control can be a good thing too.
Definitely. So, I mean, for the sort of longevity aspect or for ensuring longevity in our lifestyles, it's that balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. So your sympathetic is your fight and flight. It's then the one that's promoting adrenaline, cortisol. We want to take away from that and try and increase that parasympathetic drive. So relaxation, deep breathing, mindfulness within ourselves, and you know the aspect of meditation. There's a lot of longstanding, say, science and maybe softer journals of the importance of that. But you know, it really is important. Obviously, I don't say that to my patients. You know, if you meditate, all your psoriasis will go away. But within conjunction.
Yeah. And it is a different thing because I think that when we look at, you know, the medication is treating the rosacea, which is really important. But something like working on the stress is helping, you know, if the medication helps to calm it all down, the stress is helping there from being another flare up. You know, it's like because it's acting as that underlying trigger again, isn't it? So they are a different aspect as well. They're different. I totally agree with you. It's a whole body approach and also an approach of like combining everything together as well. So let's have a look at rosacea. Again, another condition that a lot of people struggle with. I think rosacea is often quite misunderstood, I think. A lot of people probably know a bit more about eczema maybe. Rosacea, I think, is probably one of those that is a bit more misunderstood. Again, there's other things involved that, you know, things like, I think, temperature changes. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think sort of temperature changes, certain foods, there could be histamine responses involved, I think, with rosacea as well, can't there? And there's different types as well, isn't there, of rosacea? So can you just, let's start off with sort of what are the different types, what are the subtypes of rosacea, how do they differ?
Yeah. First of all, although it's not my expertise, you've got eye rosacea, ocular rosacea. This increased grittiness in the eyes. I mean, it's probably the most common type of rosacea, actually, but probably the least talked about. I would say that because I'm a dermatologist. But you know, what I see in my clinic is what we know is this sort of red type. So you've got erythrotelangiectatic rosacea. So this is almost this redness and dilated surface blood vessels that, in response to temperatures changes, in response to stress, emotional situation, to sunshine as well. Spicy foods is typically the other one, and cayenne pepper. Alcohol, sadly, certain types of alcohol, white wine more so, according to what I read. But really, when my patients come in, they often tell me it's the red wine that is an issue. And often you get a histamine release with that. Yep. So if you have an antihistamine before you drink alcohol, it should help your rosacea, as my little top tip. I probably wouldn't say give up the alcohol. Well, it depends on which podcast we're talking about. But I would say, obviously, moderation, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to drink, try and take an antihistamine. Because yes, that we all get a bit of a histamine release, but it seems to be this accentuated response in rosacea patients. Ultraviolet radiation, so in response to going out in sunshine, so bright summer sunshine, it seems to be UVB. You seem to get, I don't think it's fully understood, but these antigen-presenting cells on the skin that seem to get a bit activated and present with a lot more immune changes. So you get a release of these flushing markers. You get redness. There's papular pustular types, and this is when you get lumps and bumps. So you get bumps that don't have any, they're not whiteheads or blackheads. They're bumps that have like pustules or just red bumps. You can get a type of rosacea where you get a thickening of the tissues in the nose. It's called rhinophyma, and it's often just the nose that develops that presentation. And sometimes just flushing, although this is an entity in itself, skin sensitivity, often patients flushing, a flushing that comes and goes rather than a permanent blush. That can be a sign of rosacea.
And what about treatments for rosacea? Whether it's, you know, conventional medicine treatments, is there any sort of skincare that can help or lifestyle things that can help to sort of reduce that, the redness and sensitivity? I mean, I'm assuming avoiding spicy foods and things like that are going to be the obvious ones with the lifestyle sort of stuff. But what sort of treatments would you be looking at for this?
When I see patients in my clinic, I do a mix of topical and lifestyle and medical treatments. And the evidence from the dermatology perspective is a number of what we call anti-inflammatory tablets and also things like retinoids, so tablet retinoids. The other thing that's actually very good for rosacea is a topical anti-parasite cream. It's called ivermectin, it's called Soolantra, and it works wonders with patients with rosacea, particularly the bumpy type. This is because the patients with rosacea seem to have this slightly more of a mite. It sounds terrible, but it's not. We're all crawling, we're teeming with things. This is our microbiome. But the microbiome in rosacea patients are slightly different. So treating that mite will also reduce down the inflammatory response that occurs in response to rosacea. And I get some beautiful results. So if it works for you, it works really well. So yeah, so what about probiotics? I think it's quite difficult to get skincare that has active probiotics in it on the skin. Plain yogurt, which has lactobacillus, and see if that helps your rosacea. But definitely, I think there is a move for that. And I really look forward and I welcome that. The gut and the skin microbiome is in crosstalk. So whatever's going on in your gut microbiome will reflect on your skin just because it changes your skin microbiome. To help with rosacea, yes, taking probiotics with Bifidobacterium lactobacillus will definitely help. Not with everyone. But theoretically, it should help. It's, you know, you need the live studies and, you know, you need lots more evidence with clinical trials to see by how much we can say that. But everything we say theoretically will not always work on everyone. It's just a fact. But then if we move to topical stuff with rosacea, really things like azelaic acid is one of our mainstays for any dermatology treatment. So it's naturally derived. It's actually from yeast known as Malassezia, and that's actually a fungus, which is on our skin, but we've isolated that. It produces an acid, and that can really help with redness in rosacea, really help with microbiome balance. Azelaic acid can also help with other things like melasma. And that's really one of my, it should be in everyone's cupboard, azelaic acid. Probably that's one of my favorite topical treatments for rosacea as well. So Soolantra and azelaic acid.
So while we're on that, because I know we're women and we all love skincare.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And we all spend probably far too much on it. If somebody's listening to this and sort of thinking, I need to go out and buy more skincare, because, you know, we probably all feel like that. Are there any sort of ingredients or formulations, or is there any actual skincare that you particularly love? Maybe sort of tailored a little bit to people who have sort of maybe sensitive skin or things like that. But is there anything, any products that you really particularly like?
We could do a new podcast on skincare, Nicole, because I can talk for hours on skincare and why. And so, it's a wonderful subject. I think probably what I would say is avoid fragrance products, because probably with patients with rosacea, they are going to have what we call this dysesthesia. So in response to different temperatures or temperature changes, or in response to products that have a lot of fragrance in them, they could develop a different sensation that could then flare their rosacea. So I'd probably say go for fragrance products that don't have like Balsam of Peru, this lemony fragrance, these hydroperoxides of limonene, linalool. But bearing in mind, fragrance-free, you may still have some preservatives in there. So fragrance-free may not necessarily be much better, but it's an option. Also, I'd probably go for things that don't have minty, aren't minty, so don't contain camphor or eugenol, or give that lovely minty smell or lavender smell. I would also then go for products that don't contain alcohol in them, and try and have more cream-based formulas rather than gel-based formulas will be helpful in rosacea. I definitely would go sunscreen and go broadband sunscreen. So there are much newer filters now. So the sunscreen filters are probably all going to be a mix of chemical and mineral filters now. So this whole aspect of having the ones that are barriers and ones that aren't. So, you know, zinc oxide to titanium dioxide are wonderful, but also anything that contains sunscreen-wise, Tinazorb, Mexoryl, these are all very stable filters, Triazorb. I would probably definitely say if you've got rosacea, go for a sunscreen and find one that suits you, actually, is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, you know, we are all slightly different as well, aren't we? So that's important. So just generally, so on any of these conditions, if we're looking at the skin support kind of from the inside, are there any particular nutrients or supplementation that you use in clinic or you recommend? Or, you know, which ones sort of do you feel have like the strongest evidence around them for helping to either repair or protect that sort of skin barrier?
Definitely, we are seeing a lot more use of oral, so probiotics, things like reishi mushrooms, a number of antioxidants, the coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, zinc supplementation. But really what I would go to is vitamin D. We all have a low in the winter months, regardless of your skin type. Darker skinned individuals will have a lower level than fairer skinned individuals. There are vitamin D receptors on not just the skin cells, but also on all organs. And I would just make, and there's a number of diseases that we know when they present, they will have low vitamin D levels. So I will say get vitamin D supplementation. I mean, I haven't taken my vitamin D for like, you know, a month, but, you know, like I said, I don't practice what I preach, but definitely try and take vitamin D supplements. Not only will it boost your immune system, but for sure you will see an improvement in the skin. Omega-3. So I'm a real fan of high-dose omega-3. 2,000 milligrams is what I'm thinking at the top of my head. But, you know, fish oils, there was a reason why a cod liver oil or a spoonful of cod liver oil was mainstay in the past. I know a lot of my patients don't like that feeling, that they feel that they have gassy fish breath is something that they tell me about. But that's one of, another one of my favorites.
The Bare Biology one I find quite good for that when people
start. Oh, do you?
Yeah, I find that's quite good. I tend to get people come back and say that they don't have an impact with the Bare Biology one. So
that is that the liquid, the baby
no,
oil?
No, they do it in cap. They do do it in. They will do the liquid in a capsule, which some people prefer. Again, the same. Some people don't like the liquid, just drinking the liquid.
The Bare Biology has safo flower oil and it has omega-3s. And that is a body oil. I know it says to drink 2.5 mils if it's the one I think you're thinking of. But on the body, it's probably the best hydration I've had recently. So
really?
Another use. Another use for it. But not for the face. Not just a high sebaceous, so your sebum producing gland, so you can increase your risk of acne. But definitely everywhere else in the body, do it.
Oh, interesting. That's a great little tip. So I think, you know, what today's kind of conversation, and I could talk to you for ages about all of this stuff, but I think what today's conversation kind of highlights is how interconnected our skin is to our sort of our body generally, and also that there's a lot out there that can be done to support our skin health. And if you have got one of these conditions, there's a lot of treatments, there's a lot of things that can be used, and that it's not just vanity, it's about how you feel, which I also think is really important. Having that sort of nice, resilient skin really does come from a place of kind of creating balance. And I think it's, like you said at the beginning, it's a feeling. It's makes you feel good. Like you said, you know, having your nails done, having your hair done, having nice, you know, having healthy skin, it's all stuff that makes us feel good about ourselves, which helps mentally. So if people are listening to this and they want to kind of start with some sort of small, consistent changes that they can make, if you could give the listeners like one simple step, if there was just something that you said, go out and do today to help improve their skin health, what would be your big kind of takeaway that you'd want them to walk away from this?
I would say my big takeaway is to spend 5 minutes a day just for yourself and actually not think about anything else but yourself. Just get into that mindfulness and you'll really notice a difference in your skin health, in your mental well-being, and also your physical presentation. Just to do with that, well, not just, but that sympathetic, parasympathetic imbalance. I think that would probably be my main thing to take away, if possible.
Love that. And it doesn't need to be for a long time either. Like you said, you know,
not even five minutes. Yeah. If you can do it even a minute, right?
Yeah. Anything helps. Yeah. No, I love that. Angela, thank you so much for joining me today. Really appreciate it. And if listeners out there are thinking, I recognize myself in one of these descriptions of, you know, eczema, psoriasis, rosacea, and they want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? What's the best way?
Oh, that's very kind. They can get in touch online. Yeah, so they can look me up and be delighted to help by the HCA at the Lister Hospital. I'm a private and NHS dermatologist, so either way.
Brilliant. We'll put a link below for people to find your Instagram and things like that. So
thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. And also thank you to the listeners as well. If you've enjoyed this episode, then make sure you've subscribed and share it with anyone that you think maybe needs a little bit of skin health inspiration today.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Good Health Podcast. Do share the episode with anyone you think it may benefit and help us to spread the word on all things health and wellness by rating, liking, or subscribing to the podcast. If you want more, you can listen to more episodes on your favourite podcast app or sign up to my newsletter for my favourite tips, tricks, health advice, brands, recipes and more at nicolegoodhealth.com/newsletter. Have a lovely week. Don't forget to hit subscribe and I'll see you on the next episode of the Good Health Podcast.